Welcome to Waldman's Words with David Bakula, who works for Nielsen, and I have not had anyone from that side of the fence on the show yet. So, if you listen, you're going to learn something, and if you don't listen, you'll still learn something. I didn't plan that before I said it, and that came out that way. So, the next few weeks are going to be fantastic on the show. Let me scroll through my smartphone, which is smarter than I am, and doop-a-doop-a-doop. We've got Leah Urbano on next week, and Leah works for Crimson Management, manages a lot of really heavy bands that could probably beat me up, but definitely cannot beat Tom up. Because Tom, who we edited out the portion wherein I gave him a shout-out, is strong. In case you don't know, Tom owns Adobe and hurts people. The following week, we've got Chris Hornbrook on the show. Chris is an incredible drummer, and I'd say 85% of the people on this show are more industry or quote-unquote industry people, but he's a drummer, he's a session drummer, and he also currently plays for Danny Harrison, who is George Harrison's son, and the Beatles don't get enough play in Adobe Radio, so I would hope that soon maybe they'll come up with a pop punk hit and it'll be great for everyone. Tom isn't laughing, but he's biting his tongue. He's biting his tom. I'm biting my time. So he also plays for Poison the Well, and he was the guy on Census Fail's last series of tours. So I'm excited about that one. That is definitely an Adobe band, Census Fail. I don't talk about Adobe as much during it, but I'm staring at Tom, and again, he's scary. And then the following week, we've got Tazy Phillips, who is the godfather of ska down in Orange County. He actually was one of the first people to give No Doubt and Sublime love. So in the mid-90s and in the late 2010s, I still rock out to ska. So stick around for Waldman's Words with me, Scott Waldman, David Bakula, Tom's Glare, and Life every single Tuesday night, 5 o'clock my time. My Tom, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, Eastern Tom. And also, Sunday mornings, bright and early, 5 a.m., when I wake up to watch the sunrise every single day, and 8 a.m. Eastern Time, which is also the same as D.C. Time or D.C. Tom. I'm going to stop. All right, so in the intro, I probably butchered Dracula's last name. So we've got David Bakula.
Now you've butchered the first name.
It's okay. You guys can't see this glare. It's piercing like Dracula's teeth.
It's the stink eye.
Wow.
I can do.
Well, garlic kills vampires. So booyakasha. Anyway, we've got David in the room. We've scheduled this interview 14 years ago. So this is really cool.
Yeah, I was actually 6 when we scheduled this. So.
I am so happy. You look great for 20. You look really good. And I'm not even going to come up with another joke because you are a great 20-year-old.
Thank you.
Anyway, we've got David in the room. David works for Nielsen, but let's go way Bakula.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
Nice.
Has that ever happened to you?
Never. No. The Dracula thing, never either.
No, I said, well, I was talking about my New York accent came out because I'm angry. You told me that that was the rhyme.
That was
so
the
that's
rhyme.
Why I did that. But way Bakula, has anyone done that?
No, I don't remember that one coming out.
Well, there you go. So I'm 1 for 2. Anyway, Mr. Bakula, talk to me about your youth and what got you into this really stupid thing called music.
This really stupid thing has been our lifeblood. It's for people like you and I.
Fist bump.
Yeah, virtual fist bump from across the room. The thing I actually remember getting me into music and getting me into the place where I landed right now is Casey's Top 40. The top 40 songs played in order for me every single week. I was a loyal listener.
Mr. Kasem.
The minute it would come out, I would start tracking for the next week, and I would listen to the radio all week and track how many times I'd heard the songs.
Wait, what's the radio?
To try to predict. Hey, yeah. No, hey, radio's still plenty relevant.
No, it's extremely relevant. Yeah. I'm just like, I'm one of the older people on this Adobe.
Yeah.
and it's a lot of younger, and sure. So like some of these kids don't think that Incubus is classic rock.
Understood. Yes. But yeah, to be able to sort of listen to the radio and predict what I thought was going to happen the next week, you know, I was doing that stuff when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, and now to turn it into a career,
what so 11
I
say? Years
I was
ago
20 yeah 11 years ago, to turn it into a career 11 years later it's a dream come true. Let's be honest,
I am honest in saying I've never had anyone from your sector on this show, so honestly I'm excited. I hope that kids in Alabama are.
Yes.
And what's funny is you brought up Casey Kasem. I haven't heard that name in a minute, but do you know how I was exposed to him?
No, I can't wait to hear it.
Saved by the Bell.
Excellent.
That's how
there
I knew
go.
Who he
yep.
was.
There you go.
And I believe that he is and always will be a hero for Mr. Ryan Seacrest.
Yes.
Like, he is that guy, and obviously Seacrest has done a few things
yeah.
since.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about music and you think about charts and you think about sort of this competition of you know, what music is more popular, it really just that was the launching point for me, for sure.
Well, what that he played specifically was your launching point, and how old were you? Let's okay, you're really 21. We can get to the brass
yep,
tacks here.
Yep.
Let's like yep. tell me about,
which is why I have a shot of tequila in front of me right now.
I mean, congratulations. Celebrating on Waldman's words. Eventually I am going to do a drunk episode.
Perfect.
But
you know what we should be celebrating today? It's International Synthesizer Day today.
The Moog?
Yeah, there you go. We should be listening to the Moog cookbook right now.
Well,
yeah.
By the time this episode airs, the book will be cooked. But today actually is the day. So let's give a moment of for the Moog. I mean, I was actually just talking about the Cars the other day. So your eyes lit up for the first time during this interview.
Love the Cars.
Yeah,
Congratulations,
the Cars.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Damn freaking right.
And they deserve it.
There's a lot of people who do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm happy that Bon Jovi got in.
Absolutely.
They've kind of outsold the world, so yes. they kind of deserve it.
And certainly out-toured the world as well.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right, let's stop digressing,
anyway,
even
yes.
though this is ADDJ. So I actually haven't said that on the air. I used that joke in passing. I try some of my material at open mics. I don't. So talk to me, though. What was that band? I can tell you for me, the first band that I got into on my own, and I'm putting in quotes, is like, because technically someone mm-hmm. somewhere shows it. Even if a band records it, they show it to you. Yeah. Weird Al, when I was a little boy, was my first like individual that I was really into.
Now, did you get into the originals that he
I love
parodied?
His originals. He,
no.
The
I'm
original,
talking about the original songs that he parodied.
Of course, he just did a tour.
So it was sort of a discovery point for you as well.
That was my yeah, that's the best way to put it, because I was exposed to the Beatles, the Who,
yes.
my mom went to Woodstock, like that kind of stuff in the house, but like that was the first thing that I got into that my parents weren't into.
Yeah.
And they actually liked it. They thought it was funny. And then in eighth grade all bets were off when I heard Green Day, Weezer, and Nirvana. But I was born in 81, so like 1994 was,
yeah.
for the record, the best year for movies and music, and my opinion is not wrong. But anyway, you.
I'm gonna
talk to me about you.
A couple of years.
No, it's fine. Some people slide forward on this show.
I would, you know, I think for me, it really was, I grew up in a real, real small town in northern Minnesota, 7,000-8,000 people.
One of the six states I haven't been to.
There you go. You know, where we play hockey 9 months out of the year because that's when the ground is frozen.
Oh, yeah.
And stop it. I'll start talking like that. Then we'd really
you don't sound like you're from there.
I've been working on that for 17 years. Yeah.
Well, don't you
know. Like I'm from here. But, yeah, I think it was one of those things where I had very little exposure to anything other than the most mainstream of music. And, you know, there was one genre in our town, and it was pop music, and it was that was really what it was. On a good night, I could get the rock station out of Duluth, Minnesota, which was kind of my exposure to rock. I would take frequent trips to visit family and friends down in Minneapolis, which I would bring a brick of blank cassette tapes down and record the radio and bring it home. And
what are
it.
Cassette tapes?
Yes,
I'm
I
sorry,
know.
I'm just going to do
know.
That again.
What are cassette tapes? What are radio? But I would record radio for, you know, days at a time. I'd put it on and then we'd go out and do some stuff and I'd come back and I'd change it and I'd I'd just record as much radio as I could to try to figure out what else was out there that I wasn't getting.
Kind of appreciate music slightly different than people do in 2018.
Boy, I think about how different that would be, and I think about the, you know, even something that's as, you know, a sort of digital terrestrial, like, you know, something like TuneIn, where I can listen to any station that I want from wherever. At the time, it would have been like getting struck by lightning for me. That would have been the most amazing thing in the world. Well, not that getting struck by lightning is amazing, but it would have been
a very
powerful experience. Let's put it that way.
Well, with Spotify and with right now with YouTube, I mean, they didn't have that when I was younger. Yeah. I would have to. I relied a lot on compilations.
Yeah.
Yep. Because it was a cheap way of exposing
KTEL records for Minnesota. KTEL was real big there.
Represent.
And that was one of the big like when you could find the, you know, rock hits of today and things like that. That's how I discovered. I remember discovering ELO that way. I remember discovering Blue Oyster Cult that way. I remember, you know, Eddie Money was there. It was all of those sort of, you know, what we would consider, I guess, classic rock acts that I discovered there. And that's when I started to move a little bit from the pop music of the, you know, the Hall and Oates and some of the big artists of the day, which I still love, no question. But, you know, my mom was kind of into that more easy listening stuff. She's a big Barry Manilow fan. And when you're 10 or 12 years old, being a Barry Manilow fan is not the coolest thing in the world.
I would argue the opposite, but that's the difference
being
between you and
being strong enough to be a Barry Manilow fan when you're 12. And today, again.
Guilty pleasures are lame, bro.
It's all come full circle. Oh, God, I've got a list of people that I would never mention that I like.
You don't have to.
If I was at the cool kids party. But, yeah, I think that's where, you know, I started to get into rock, classic rock, and then, you know, the classic rock stations of the time. When I was kind of in my, you know, early teens, classic rock was it for me. And then in the middle 80s, when you were just kicking around with your Rattler and your things like that, mm-hmm. I was kind of in my, you know, junior to high school years where big hair bands of the 80s were big for me.
It's kind of big in this area of Los Angeles, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
The Sunset Strip scene.
The acts of the Sunset Strip scene were definitely big for me. But the thing is, I didn't have exposure to anything else. You know, I still remember some of the, you know, again, kind of throwing it back to the synthesizer days of, I still remember sort of those first new wave songs that were crossing over, you know, when Devo had
I was literally about to say Devo.
Of course, when Devo had a big hit, when Adam Ant had a big hit. And that was sort of my first exposure when I remember the first time I heard U2's New Year's Day. Like, this is different. This is something. But really, until I got out of high school, again, in a town of less than 10,000 people, you just don't get a lot of exposure to that. And went off to college.
What school?
University of Arizona, Bear Down, Wildcats.
Word. Tuscan?
Yep. And
it's a cold region.
Yeah, it's balmy. But that was sort of where, you know, when you go to a big school like that, you get exposed to a lot of different people and your influences go a lot of different ways. I actually only went there for a couple of years, went back to Minnesota, finished at the University of Minnesota, go Gophers. And
you know, I went to Michigan, so that whole brown jug thing.
Yeah, there you go. You can have the brown jug.
No, I'm not going to be a dick about it. Like, honestly,
it's not a rivalry if one team wins all the time.
That is true, but I get into things where people from, because obviously Ohio State, Michigan's a semi-big deal in that college sports stuff, and they always, if anyone ever finds out I go to Michigan, they go to Ohio State, and I'm just like, okay. And if they keep going, I'm just like, yo, were you on the football team?
Yeah.
Did you go there for academics? And then they stop.
Yeah.
Yep. 10 times out of 10.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Minnesota is, I think outside of hockey, Minnesota's that school that I think everybody in the Big Ten kind of looks at and goes, oh, they're still in our conference. Yeah. You know, not real competitive there, but
I would like to try a Juicy Lucy. So it's like, I'm not kissing your ass. I've never been to Minnesota. I have nothing positive or negative to say about the state.
It's a wonderful place.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Minneapolis is supposed to be sick. Motion City soundtrack, Semisonic, Prince.
Fantastic music scene. Yeah, they definitely punch above their weight in the music scene. You know,
they're isolated.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think they had a great Americana sort of wave that came through with bands like the Jayhawks, and same time Soul Asylum was big. The Replacements were kind of, it's just starting to be on their way down, and you know, Westerberg was going off on his own.
You know, I had Matt Wallace on this show. Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about them on this show.
Yeah.
I'm giving my own show a shout out on Waldman's Words, which you could tune in every single Tuesday. Anyway.
So, yes, but that's, yeah, so great exposure. I remember, you know, I think a lot of people, when they say, I remember the first time I heard Prince, they're referring to Purple Rain, sometimes 1999. I do remember the first time I heard, you know, Controversy, and the first time I heard For You, and, you know, some of the really deep Prince stuff, which was big with some of my friends in Minneapolis. And, you know, getting the exposure to that, you know, Prince, I don't think it's a Minnesota thing. Prince is just...
Well, Prince is a global thing, but started in Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he, the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So...
Grew up 30 miles from where Bob Dylan was born, so...
Robert Zimmerman?
Yes, Robert Zimmerman, that one. But yeah, great musical influences there. And again, when I got to college there, and the college scene at that time, the college radio scene was... you know, littered with, you know, the big, sort of the pre-grunge acts were sort of my favorite time.
So like the late 80s?
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. You had a lot of great Britpop coming over. You had a lot of, you know, REM and sort of that southeastern swing. I love, you know, a bunch of bands from there. And a lot, just a lot of great variety.
I like hearing that you like music, because sometimes I talk to quote unquote suits. I mean, you're dressed better than some people who come here, but I talk to some suits and it doesn't seem like they're into music. And I'm just like, you can make so much more money in other fields. Like, why are you doing this?
That's true. But you also, I don't think you will ever get the passion and the satisfaction out of anything like you will for music. Yeah, sure. I've been running numbers for a long time. I'm very analytical, and you know, while a lot of people might say that, go, oh, well, yeah, you take your job and go anywhere. You could forecast this. You can project that.
You wouldn't be as passionate about it.
Yeah, you can be an actuary. You can do all this stuff in insurance. Yeah, none of that stuff is going to give me any satisfaction in life at all. So double my salary and ruin my life. You know what? I think I'm pretty happy here.
I think that you made the right move. That's what, whenever people tell me as I'm like on the EBT line at Ralph's, people, I'm like, well, at least I'm trying something cool.
Yep. Scraping together a couple nickels.
I'm trying to turn a dollar into three.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that was kind of the early influences on music for me. And I guess why I got so passionate for it. And then, you know, I think a lot like, a lot of people, a high percentage of people in our circles, in our sort of employment circles, are either musicians who are looking to make a living wage while they make music.
Or super fans.
Which is awesome. Or super fans who cannot make music, which is me. I've tried every single instrument that I've ever wanted to play, and I can't play a note on any of them. So, you know, not unlike... I love good wine, but I don't know how to crush a grape. I don't know how to make the music, but I sure
I screwed
know.
Up a corkscrew yesterday.
Yeah. See, those things are complicated. You got to be smarter than
And
the
we
cork.
Have even a one I was trying to impress my buddy with our fancy, like, $14 one, where you guys can't see me, all of you people listening, all 10 gazillion of you. But
count yourselves as lucky right now.
Who isn't? So I put it on, and it's a special one where you lock it in and you do it, and it is foolproof. I have never messed this up. And I tell my friend, and of course messes up. And this is an analogy I give for the cocky people on American Idol. They always suck. So I should have went into it. You're laughing. It's a silent laugh, but I'll take it. And I should have went into it and be like, I'm not as good as this, but it should be easier. And it didn't work. Anyway, wine.
Wine. Yes.
Wine, woman, and walleye.
Yeah. Wine, women, and Waldman.
Oh!
Come on.
Waldman's word.
How did you miss that?
I mean, I don't look at it as a miss. I look at it as I passed you the ball and you alley-ooped
that. A little tap in.
But you know what's fine.
So
you're doing I fucked up.
You're doing
I fucked
basketball
up.
Analogies and I'm doing hockey.
Ayo. But yours wasn't an analogy. Yours was no, you were talking about.
And I actually had the invisible stick in my hand.
You blocked by the sound process. But no, I actually, the reason why we met, let's actually get into that. Okay. So this is our third time, which is a charm, and we met, I'm not even sure, it was, I feel like there was just some kind of email exchange, and then you met with me at Blue Bottle Coffee in Culver City.
That is correct.
And I think maybe like 20 minutes into that meeting, I said, I think you'd be a great guest for the show. We booked it. We went out and had drinks with a person who works for the company of Rolling Artists, Johnny Rago, And I met a bunch of people at Nielsen at a bar in Hollywood across the street from the Palladium. What's the name of that bar?
It's called The Well.
The Well.
That is
That's
our,
it.
Our local hang. Our office is in that building, and The Well, it's a little bit like, you know, that's where we do our residency.
Your residency. That's funny. Every Tuesday night. Yeah. No, I believe that was even on a Friday.
That was on a Friday night, yeah.
Yeah, because Johnny and I went to – I like giving shout-outs to places I like. I like The Well. We went to 800 Degrees and had pizza.
Wonderful.
With that place. I'm a New Yorker, and that's money. And so I honestly do have positive things to say about you, but I want to hear –
I'm not going to say any of them.
I think you're smart. I think you're articulate. I think you're funny. I think for 20 years old, you're a beautiful man.
I've really matured well. Yes.
So was that quick rapid fire? Anyway, so you work for Nielsen, and we have about 3 or 4 minutes right now to wrap up segment one, and I want to highlight Nielsen as much as possible in the second half. But tell me about, I guess, when you graduated college, and you, yes, because I know some of this because we've spoken, but the people listening don't.
Yeah.
When you realized you were a super fan and you wanted to do stuff in music that didn't involve playing rhythm guitar for The Replacements.
Right, or spinning records on a radio station or something like that, which always sounded a lot of fun.
This is a radio station.
Yeah. That was, but I think the thing, when I was in college, I always thought I wanted to go to law school, and I ended up double majoring in sociology and political science, none of which has anything to do with music. And
English right here, dude.
What I actually found as I was sort of wrapping up my sociology part was that I was really fascinated with measurement of human behavior, the sort of the numbers behind the sociology, the statistics behind the sociology. And a good friend of mine from college was working for the Musicland Group at the time, Musicland Group, which owned all the Sam Goody stores, if anybody remembers those.
I used to go to one in Long
Island.
Suncoast
Video they owned, and we had some Media Play stores and some On Cue stores. So we had stores all over the place, and they needed somebody to help them do forecasting and inventory management, which was basically make sure you buy enough of the records that everybody's going to want, which sounded just beyond cool. And that was, and I applied for the job, and I guess what ended up happening was, while I didn't really have any experience in said job, you know, there wasn't anything I could walk in and say, oh yeah, I've done something just like this before. The hiring manager noticed my passion. You know, he had some tchotchkes laying around in his office, and I remember he had a coffee mug that was the artwork on it was the Division Bell by Pink Floyd.
That's a cool.
And he said,
Pink Floyd kill it with the art.
Yeah, and he said, what do you want? What do you want out of your career in 5 years? I said, I want to be somewhere where I have an office that has a coffee mug of Pink Floyd's Division Bell in it. He's like, oh yeah, you like this? You can. And he gave me the mug, and it was just it was bringing, you know, I think finally for the first time bringing my passion to something where I'm like, you know what, I can make a living out of this. And yeah, 5 years at Musicland. After that, I jumped over to Universal. Working on the distribution label side, and was a catalog sales rep in Minneapolis, selling to Best Buy and Target and Musicland, and trying to get them to buy, you know, some more Rolling Stones and some more Nirvana and things like that. So
we actually got to cut this off and take to segment two.
Excellent.
But thank you for initiating that. We will discuss from Universal to Nielsen to Burbank Waldman's Words Studio. So stick around for David Bakula.
Yes, just like Dracula.
I bet you've never heard that before.
Never. Not since we started.
Stick around. We are back with David Bakula, whose name, again, I may have mispronounced in the intro, but he's her. Yes, a real laugh. Yes. Start the she with the loof.
Yeah.
Was that a pity laugh?
Don't forget, I'm from Minnesota. Everything sounds goofy to me.
I don't know what it sounds like to be from Minnesota.
Yeah, it's kind of like Canadian, but not quite. Southern Canada. Or Canada's northern Minnesota.
So you're kind of the U.S. America state that gets shite on?
A little bit.
I have no problem with Minnesota. Again, I can tell you some states that I'm not into. I'll say a few right now. Alabama, Mississippi. That's two.
Wow.
Yep, I did it.
And to those listeners that used to listen from Alabama and Mississippi.
Yeah, I know. You should never, ever offer your own opinion on things.
Ever.
No, I've actually learned this on Facebook. We can go into this for a second. I pretty liberal guy, and I used to proselytize on Facebook, and then I was just thinking, like, it's never a dialogue.
No.
It's never. It's people talking to hear themselves talk. It's extended monologues. When I drive by a car that has an anti-abortion sticker, I don't look at the sticker and go, they're right. It just doesn't happen.
Or
so,
they're wrong, whichever. Yeah.
Whatever, you know, exactly. I'm showcasing. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is my show. Yep. So, yep. But so I've just learned to stop doing that.
It's a little bit like that with music, though. It's such a personal thing that I think the only downside or the only bad answer to what kind of music do you like is either I don't really listen to music, which I don't have anything to talk about.
I do not understand
people,
you.
Or the people that say, I listen to a little bit of everything. Yeah, okay, you can listen to a little bit of everything, but don't tell me you love everything because it's so different. It's so individual.
And that's for people who just aren't really invested
right,
in it.
Who don't have a great answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you come up to me and you tell me, I love music, I'm so passionate about music, my three favorite bands are A, B, and C, and not ABC because they're a great band.
ABBA, but, Beatles, and Creed.
Sure, but if those are your three favorite bands in Creed.
Well, see, you're laughing, but it's so subjective.
But that's the thing. I can't sit here and judge you and say, oh, you know what, you got horrible taste in music. You don't have horrible taste in
music. You can judge, but you're a douche if you do.
Right, exactly. Or I can say, you know what, that I hate those three bands, which I don't. But if I said, you know what, I hate those three bands, we can totally agree that we may not like the same bands, but we still have the same passion for music.
It's subjective. You don't know what pizza tastes like to me might taste like filet mignon to you.
Exactly.
So it's completely and then going back to politics, and then we're going to talk about the quote unquote important stuff like Universal to Nielsen.
We're going to need a third segment.
Believe we might,
yep.
But we can't do that.
Okay, good.
Just stop yelling at me. I don't tell you how to do your job. So the thing is I have learned in my 37 years, you'll learn when you're in your 30s.
When I get to my mid-30s, yeah.
That for everyone, it's different, but I believe what I believe, and I feel with politics, I feel that I can publicly state something if I am actively doing something
yes.
for it. So if I am marching against the NRA, then I feel I can do it. But if I am just anti-guns and I am just lounging on my couch in my boxers, I feel like my voice, it's just noise.
Yeah. Yep.
So do we agree on that?
Absolutely.
Yay!
Yeah. Yeah. No, if you're one of those millions of people who doesn't even bother to go and vote or understand the issues before you go and vote, I'm sorry, but I just don't have a lot of respect for your opinion unless you're engaged. And
wait, what'd you say?
I said, yeah, exactly. You need to be engaged. Come on. But that's, again, that's the same way that it is with music.
So I love Alabama and Mississippi. I do.
Good. Wink's as good as a nod to a
Why'd you
bass.
Do that? Why'd you say I winked? My God, they can't see me. All right. Back to Bacula.
Back to Bacula.
That sounds like an incredible sequel to a movie in the 80s. Bacula 1.
Right. So, yeah, back to that.
Universal.
Universal. So, yeah, started there and very quickly found that my calling was not going to be in sales. I am not much of a negotiator. I really do have a passion for this industry as a whole, and I want the industry to be healthy, and I want the industry to do well, and I want everybody to be successful and everybody to get paid. And you know, sometimes that requires you to sell things that you don't necessarily believe in, which makes things a little bit challenging. And
if you work for a label, you're not going to believe in every artist on it.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. And it was a little bit challenging for me to do that. Now, that being said, I think my bosses, my company at the time, were very, very forward-looking and recognized that fact very quickly, that my passion was really in the business and the numbers behind the business. We started the analytics group, a dedicated analytics group at Universal in 2000. I moved from Minnesota to Los Angeles. So that's...
Can you explain what analytics are to someone listening who has no idea?
Yeah, I think, you know, on a business that's really based on gut and based on feeling and based on emotion very much. Yeah. It's also very predictable. There are signals, there are things that patterns that you can recognize that will indicate, hey, this thing's going to be a smash, or you know what, we could throw all the money in the world at this thing and it's never really going to break through. And, you know, being able to put some science and some numbers behind the artistry, behind the product, was really what we were hoping for. So, you know, certainly as I go back to 2000 when I kind of started looking at the numbers, or even 95 when I started at Musicland looking at the numbers there, understanding the trends in the industry, there have been a lot of changes since then. You know, we've gone from the days of everything's on CD or cassette even at the time, to Napster is destroying our business, to what is this internet thing?
We Napster have to is have my a college
there. Yeah,
that was literally happening when I was in college. When I was a sophomore in college in the year 2000, yep. That's when it was. And I can tell you this, for that Napster was in every single person's computer in their dorm room.
Yep.
I asked every single student in the world and they confirmed this.
Yep. But how many elements of Napster are on every single person's computer, smartphone, tablet, home speaker now? It's really hasn't changed that much outside of the fact that it's actually legal and monetized and working for everybody within the ecosystem, from the largest technology companies in the world like Google and Amazon and Apple all the way down to the smallest artist, you know, somebody who may have one song that they self released.
Can we go into an opinion thing quickly? Yeah. Yay. Okay. So I know my opinion on states. It is my show, but it is your thing. And I try to make this engaging and actually have dialogue. And I love what you're saying. And you inspired something. So I think not a dirty five-letter word, think that if the labels had embraced MP3s, like M4As, whatever, and had really noticed that people were sharing music this way for free, if they had embraced it and tried selling it then, I feel that it would have been more of a reflex for someone to purchase mm-hmm. a song in digital form. That's my stance. Thoughts?
I think the technology that goes along with that sort of thought process, or that you know, how is the ownership of this going to change, or the access to this going to change? I don't know that at the time that Napster was as successful as it was, the technology, and I think the political atmosphere at the record labels and distribution companies and publishers and things like that just wasn't really there yet. It was an idea ahead of its time that honestly the music business probably didn't fully understand. And when they did, and they got great technology partners to come along for the ride in the early 2000s, I mean, yeah, I think we did really well after that.
I agree. But again, going back to my question, do you think...
The question I'm trying to avoid.
If you... Okay, then you know what? Who did you vote for? Yes. So anyway,
yep.
That's my stance on that.
You don't want to know.
I actually probably don't, but it's okay. Because I can say this. There are people that voted for the other guy that... I like his people.
Yeah, but I'm so far down the ballot, you don't even... I would say 97% of the people don't even know who my candidate was. So.
Billy Bob Thornton. You voted for him, and he won the hearts of many in Sling Blade. So,
yeah,
talk to me about Nielsen.
So, yeah, after about 9 years at Universal of running analysis and data there, over to Nielsen. You know, working with Universal, obviously the largest record company in the world from a market share perspective, and have a stable of incredible artists, even that world to me was, my visibility to the rest of the music world was very limited. I didn't know what was going on with, competitive artists. At the time, you have a huge... a globe of visibility at Universal, and pun intended, I guess, with the globe. But with Universal, you do have such a huge roster that you can learn a lot by just looking at your own artists. But it's not everything, and it's Nielsen was really, to me, that's the kid in the candy store. You know, you've just let me in and said, here's all the data in music. Here's everything that we have. And again, I think that was where my passion for numbers and my passion for the content kind of shown through to get an opportunity to do what I was sort of doing at Universal, but move it over to Nielsen and do it for the industry as a whole.
What year was this?
This was 2008.
Okay.
Yeah, so it'll be my 10-year anniversary good Lord willing, if I make it to August, it'll be my 10-year anniversary. Mazel tov. With Nielsen.
I hope that in a few months your position is stable.
Yeah, me too. Me too. But that was the one thing, you know, even through the sort of the lean years when the record companies were going through a lot of cutbacks and when the trends were going down, thankfully they're not anymore, but when the trends were going down, the analysis team was one team that never was touched by layoffs, never was cut back. We went from me as one person in 2000, and when I left there, there were 16 people, you know, between market research and analysis. So, you know, it was a great growth area to be in if you've got a passion for it. There are very few people that have a huge aptitude for numbers and a huge passion for music. And those people, quite honestly, even today, I think can still kind of write their ticket in the music business, the business side of the music business. You're not taking the
art. It's quite a skill set.
Yeah, yeah. You're not taking the art out of artistry. You're just putting some detail behind it. You're putting some thought behind it, some analysis behind it.
Some data.
And that's where, you know, I think Nielsen and sort of their position within the industry as, you know, not just people that power the Billboard charts. You know, that's an important thing to make sure that the Billboard charts are defendable and correct and accurate and everything works exactly the way it should. And that's a really a critical job for us to make sure that we're working with them on everything that is chart related, but also being able to give accurate, valid reporting and critical analysis looking forward. And taking that from just, you know, here's what the weather was yesterday to here's what the weather's going to be in 2 days, that's
forecasting.
It really comes down to forecasting and analysis. And if you don't understand the industry, you know, you may have 2 years ago, you may have looked at this streaming thing and thought, oh, yeah, it's a quarter of the business. Great. This thing might actually catch on someday and not realize that.
My eyes are actually going all over the place now because now I manage bands.
Yeah.
As you know, I manage producers and your Spotify numbers are just as important as what song was on your MySpace profile was years ago. That is literally everything for now.
Yep.
And it's crazy how integral it is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you think about, you know, how important the right radio station was and still continues to be. But now you've got another tool in your box. You know, you can get on a great playlist. You can get on a playlist that's followed, you know, Rap Caviar, I think, is one of the examples that everybody always brings up, is how much discovery is going on with Rap Caviar, and then you have the additional step of being able to add that to your own playlist, to share it with the other friends that you have, that social element, again, going right back to the Napster days of, hey, you know what, I just gobbled up this person's entire catalog, and look at all this great stuff that he has here that I've heard of, and all this other great stuff that I've never heard of that this person has and thinks is good music. Mm-hmm. And that's the discovery and the social element of that. And that's where I think streaming really does. It goes beyond, you know, simply that you've got artists who, you know, may have a complaint with the rates that are being paid and things like that. And look, it's all over the news and people are writing about it all the time. But I think we're kind of missing that additional value that
more people are hearing things than ever
the
before.
The discovery, the you know, how engaged a person is with that artist or with that music. And, you know, how many extra shows are they going to? How many extra things are they buying? And the engagement that they have with the artist, I think, is just fascinating.
I mean, there's pros and cons to everything.
Yeah.
And I have a question because we obviously brought up Spotify. Do the people at Nielsen deal with the people at Spotify?
Absolutely.
So do you talk to the playlist curators? Or, like, I don't know.
There's absolutely a flow of information between the two, you know, from intelligence and analysis from our side, you know, market share and things like that. You know, Spotify obviously has the best view of what is going on within their ecosystem. They know exactly what's going on, exactly how many people played this, from where they played it, what they did with it after
for how long they played it.
Yeah. What we have is, hey, you know what? Not every single second of that person's day is being spent on Spotify. So here's what's happening in other places. Here's what your share of that market is. Hey, you're doing this. This looks like you're doing it really well. But you know what? When we blend it in with all the rest of the industry, turns out you're actually under indexing on this particular thing or that particular thing. So
only so many hours in the day, right?
Yeah. They may be sitting back thinking, hey, and I'm making these up because I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but they may be sitting back thinking, hey, we're really great at reggae. People come to us and they love reggae. They love our playlists on reggae. And then they might look at the thing and find out that they're 40% of all streams, but they're only 8% of reggae. And they go, wow, we thought we were awesome at this, and it turns out we kind of stink at it. So what are we going to do to get better at that? So having that broad view of the entire market and be able to say, you know, not just how am I doing, but how am I doing relative to everybody else? And that's the real core of everything, is making it relative. You know, charts are the same thing. Mm-hmm. Hey, you sold 400,000 this week. That's great. Am I number one or am I number 400? Okay.
And 400,000 now is astronomically high.
Why did you make you number one?
But more than double.
Yeah.
But
then again, you get, you know, it's really not about, well, it's really not about selling so much anymore, because a good, you know,
consuming
nearly 2/3 of the chart is driven by streaming. And you get artists like Post Malone who can get 400 plus million streams in
just beat the Beatles.
It's unbelievable.
Yep.
So really incredible access and engagement with music. And I think the charts are reflecting that. And that's where Billboard does just a phenomenal job of saying, you know what, over the years, we have measured what is the biggest, whatever, song, album, whatever it is, artist in music, and adjusting their charts to be able to say, this is what really makes an artist relevant right now.
Well, speaking of relevance, I want to make David Bakula more relevant to everyone in the world. And I can tell you that we're actually wrapping this up, which is good. This segment actually, surprisingly, like, I'm obviously more into learning about, like, bands in particulars. I mean, most people are. But this actually was quicker, which is weird. So congratulations to you for making something that might be dry to someone else interesting. But I just want to give Emily Burke, my incredible assistant slash co-host when she is not in school, a shout out. She sent me a text with an outline of you. And the very last segment of that text was a very informative Twitter. So I would like it if she is a muckraker, so she might have found something that's private. Is that public?
Oh, absolutely.
So can you tell people how they can? And by the way, just so you know, I'm giving myself a pound back. This is the best transition I've ever had to getting someone to plug their socials. So mazel tov to me.
Thank you. Obviously from
thank you.
From a Twitter standpoint, yes, you can follow me at Dave Bakula, at DaveBakula. And that's, you know, everything that I think is interesting, and I dig through a lot of numbers, and there, I do a lot of presentations. We just got through convention season.
I'm following you right now, by the way.
Yes, with Canadian Music Week, straight into Music Biz, and a lot of big industry conventions out there, and we do a lot of presentations with Nielsen. I was on 3 panels in one day at Music Biz, for example, and when you do things like that, you get 20 minutes of content, but in order to get the 20 minutes of content, you got to do about 3 days worth of work. And 90% of it ends up on the cutting room floor. So once in a while, I'll find something that I think, hey, this is pretty interesting, but really doesn't merit public, you know, a public presentation.
You don't have to talk about everything publicly that you like.
Yeah, right. But I'll throw that into Twitter once in a while and just say, hey, this is really an amazing number, or this is really something that was surprising to me. You know, once in a while, some Mythbusters in there as well.
So, Mythbusters.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we don't want people thinking things that aren't true.
You know what? I appreciate that. I know that opinions are never true. They are opinions, and everyone has them. But facts don't lie, which is, I guess, the really good way to close out you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Then, yes, trust the numbers.
Trust the numbers.
Yep.
And I guess, how can people learn more about Nielsen? How can people learn more about you that isn't on Twitter?
Yeah, I think, you know, from the Nielsen perspective, we have a lot of tools. We do a lot of things. We just we acquired Gracenote last year, which is a company that is really just the gold standard for things like metadata and how important metadata is. That's a whole other segment or two segments of how important metadata, the right metadata, is to getting paid, getting heard, getting successful in this industry. And Gracenote is the gold standard for that. So bringing those two things together, you can always reach out to us, know@nielsen.com, not N-O, but K-N-O-W, know as in knowledge, @nielsen.com.